We're back. Yeah, good to see you. If you're online, good to see you. We're all one, whether we're online or here, we're all together on this thing. Well, we're going to cover another attribute of God. It's an attribute. An attribute is a quality, a characteristic of God. What is God really like? And so if you want to understand God, you have to go to the Bible and try and study the attributes. And the theologians tell us there's two kinds. There's communicable attributes and incommunicable attributes. Communicable attributes are attributes that we have along with God. So God is loving, we can be loving. God is kind, we can be kind. Then there are incommunicable attributes, which we can't have. Right? And we've studied some of them already. God is omnipresent. We can't be everywhere at all time. God is all-powerful. We're certainly limited in our power. So those are the attributes. Today we're going to study an attribute of God, which is that God is jealous. And this one causes all kinds of problems. And the reason why it causes problems is because people use the wrong definition for jealousy. They use the world's definition. God is not jealous like you and I are. Just this week, I don't know, it's because I'm 65 now, I got that glossy magazine in the mail, and there was a guy on there from, I think he was from Sarasota, Florida. He had abs at 65. He had abs that were incredible. And yeah, you watch that, and you look at that, and I'm 65, and I'm thinking, I used to have abs like that. And I just got one big one. So when I look at guys that are 65 and they're really in great shape, I'm thinking, yeah, I get a little jealous sometimes. I think men are at a disadvantage in this area. I really do. Because women, they have a lot of options to kind of upgrade their appearance. They buy products like CoverGirl, New Skin, Age Diminishing Cream, Concealer. You're a 65-year-old man, you look in that mirror in the morning when you get up, and you think, this is about as good as it's going to be all day. And that's before you get on the scale. So, yeah, we get jealous, but that's not the definition of jealousy when you're talking about God. For you and I, jealousy happens, it occurs when someone else has something that we want, or someone else is being praised, or someone else is being recognized, or someone else is more successful than we are, we can become jealous. God is not like that because God has no needs. He's independent. He doesn't have a personality problem. God is never insecure. God is not jealous of anyone or anything. So when we talk about that God is, when we say that God is jealous, we're not saying it in the negative way that we usually use the term. The Hebrew word for jealousy can be translated zealousness or passion. So when we say God is jealous, we're saying God is passionate or he's jealous. Now, if you're taking notes, you want to take these notes, what I'm going to say now. He's jealous about two things. Number one, to preserve his integrity and character. Two, to preserve his people. When we say that God is jealous, in the scriptures, it describes he's jealous about two things, to preserve his intelligence, and his integrity and character in the world, and secondly, to preserve his people. Anything that threatens the integrity of God, God hates it. Anything that threatens God's people, God is going to hate it. He's not only going to hate it, he's going to avenge it. If my love for my wife Judy is mature, then I ought not to be envious of her when she receives praise or admiration from other people, or begrudge her if she becomes a success at something. I ought to rejoice in her successes and join others in praising qualities in the character of Judy. But there is one thing I can be jealous of, and that's whatever threatens the integrity of the commitment that we made to one another 37 years ago. Whatever attacks our marriage or our marriage vows that we made to each other, I can be jealous and very, very protective of that. So let's see how the Bible describes a scene where God is jealous. And to take that scene, I'm going to go back to the Old Testament, to the book of Nahum. Nahum is an Old Testament prophet that's called to preach to people who are living in the city of Nineveh. You know Nineveh from Jonah. And there, Nineveh, of course, is the capital of this large empire, powerful empire at that time, called Assyria. And there are two themes in the book of Nahum. The first is the pride of man. The second is the jealousy of God. First, the pride of man. Several weeks ago, when I commented on the rioting in American cities, I told you that you can't ignore the cities because God cares about cities. Why? Well, because there's lots of people in cities. In fact, in 1950, 20% of the world's population lived in cities. In 1975, 39% of the world's population lived in cities. In 2018, 55% of the people in the world, roughly a little bit more than half of the people, live in city. And they're saying in two decades, 70 to 75% of the people will live in a city. You think about that. Three quarters of the world is going to live in cities. And if you're wondering how many Americans live in U.S. cities, well, before I give you a statistic, why don't you turn to the person next to you, if you came with them, and tell them what you think. How many people live in cities in the United States? Go. Okay, you ready? Here it is. 63% of Americans live in cities. Almost two-thirds of Americans. Listen, if you use the term urban, which is the surrounding areas around a major city, you're talking about 80% of Americans live in an urban area, though they occupy only 4% of the land area. What does that tell you? These places are pretty crowded. I know that. I grew up in the shadow of New York City. I am so glad I live in Wisconsin for lots of reasons right now. I know that God cares about the cities because of the people there, but I thank God every day. I'm a Badger right now for sure. Now watch God call me to be the chaplain of the New York Giants. I got to go back there. Cities are the symbol. They really are. Cities are a symbol of man's great achievements, right? Why, we got our skyscrapers there, our buildings, headquarters. And I don't care what city you're talking about, there's kind of a pride or an arrogance to every city. This was certainly true of Nineveh. Nineveh, by the way, if you don't know this, is one of the oldest cities to exist since the flood. In recent years, archaeologists have gotten a lot of data on Nineveh. Nineveh was actually what we call a quad city. There were four cities combined as one. And this great city called Nineveh was founded by whom? By Nimrod. Yes, he's talked about in Genesis chapter 10. And what we know about Nimrod from Genesis is that he was a great hunter. He was a warrior. He was a killer. A man of blood. And what's very interesting is that the city he founded ended up developing that kind of reputation. Nineveh was not only the capital of the Assyrian Empire, it was known for its brutality. Look what Nahum says here in chapter 3. What sorrow awaits Nineveh, the city of murder and lies. She is crammed with wealth and never without victims. Hear the crack of whips, the rumble of wheels. Horses' hooves pound and chariots clatter wildly. See the flashing swords and the glittering spears as the chariots charge past. There are countless casualties, heaps of bodies, so many bodies that people stumble over them. Nineveh, no question about it, was symbolic of bloodshed and brutality and murder, just like its founder was noted for. The city of blood. Now, we also know that Nineveh was one of the strongest and most protective cities in the world at that time. You know, if you go to Israel And or you just study ancient history, you know that the way that cities were attacked was by siege. The army that was attacking would surround the city, cut off food, cut off water, until the people starved, and they had to come out, and then that's how they defeated the city. They didn't attempt to defeat the city with its walls. Well, they say that Nineveh had almost a perfect structural defense against any siege. Nineveh was about 60 miles around in circumference, about the size of London. It had at that time, this is how large it was, 1 million inhabitants. At that time, that was huge. By the time of Nahum, you got 1 million people living there. But its defense was centered in the inner city, which is often the case. The people in the farmlands would come back to the inner city for protection. And it had a wall 100 feet high. Think about that. Okay? 15 miles around in circumference. On top of that 100-foot wall, they had towers also 100 feet high. And around the city was a moat. Around the wall was a moat 140 feet wide, archaeologists tell us, 60 feet deep. Nineveh, they said, could withstand a siege by a marauding army for 20 years. You'd have to camp out there 20 years to defeat the city. That's how impregnable it was. All of this meant it was a city that had adopted an arrogance and a pride. Who can defeat us? Who can defeat Nineveh? Who can penetrate our defenses? Who can scale our walls? Who can bridge our moat? No one will ever be able to conquer us. Nineveh not only thumbed its nose at the world, it thumbed its nose at God. And it thought it could get away with it. Nineveh, the pride of man. You know, C.S. Lewis, he called man's pride the great sin. Let me read what he writes about it. There's one sin of which no man in the world is free, which everyone in the world loathes when he sees it in somebody else, of which hardly any people ever imagine that they are guilty of themselves. I've heard people admit that they're bad-tempered, they can't keep their heads about girls or drink, or even that they're cowards. I don't think I've ever heard anyone who was not a Christian accuse himself of this vice. And at the same time, I have very seldom met anyone who showed the slightest mercy to it in others. There is no fault which makes a man more unpopular, and no fault which we are more unconscious of in ourselves. And the more we have it ourselves, the more we dislike it in others. The great sin I'm talking about is pride. Proverbs chapter 6 lists 7 sins that God especially hates. You know what the first one is? Let's take a look at it. There are 6 things the Lord hates, 7 that are detestable to him. And the first one is haughty eyes. Haughty is another word for proud. A haughty look is to look at people and think that you're superior to them in the look, or to disdain them. And the truth is, folks, we all suffer from it. We all do. I say this often. I get people disagree with me, but I think it's true. I think men suffer a little bit more from it than women. I know that's a sexist comment, but men tend to have bigger egos than women. But all of us suffer from the great sin of pride. But it's one thing to be proud with other people. It's a whole other thing to be proud at God. And Nahum has a message for Nineveh because they were proud against God. How's little Israel going to protect themselves from us? And Nahum is ready to preach. God is ready to deal with Nineveh and its national pride. Now, we have to be careful about this. I'm very proud to be an American, despite all of our problems, I'm still very thankful that I was born in this country, that I live in this country. You know, what you need to do is you need to get on a plane and go to third world or second world countries and realize that when you come back here, every time I come back, and I do, I travel the world, every time I come back, I say to the border officer, I am sure glad to be back home in the United States. And they say, welcome back. But while I'm very proud to be an American, the truth is, I am not proud of some of the things America's doing. I want to talk more about that in 2 weeks. I'm going to talk about that. But all of it screams to me sometimes that there's pride, not only in man, but in this country. Our country's becoming more and more godless, God-neglecting, God-belittling, and more, God-blaspheming. And we may be in for a period of great difficulty because of it. There's a time when God says, I've had enough. I teach on end times all the time. Every 2 years I teach on end times. And I study it again. And every time I'm studying the end times, it's very clear. I don't care what kind of gymnastics you do exegetically. The United States is not in there. It's just not in there. I'm thinking, how could that be? Why isn't there this great, powerful country from the West? Why it's not in there? I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. But more and more, I think, and it's not going to be a military thing. It's going to be more of destruction from within. Story is told in ancient Greece about a man who won the wrestling championship of his day, and all the glory and accolades and cheers were there, and everybody was impressed with this muscle-bound man, except one elderly man. And as the champion left the crowd with all of his trophies, an old man calls out to him. He says, I want to ask you a question. You see that statue there in the distance? You know who that represents? And the wrestler says, yeah, that used to be the wrestling champion years ago. And the old man says, that's correct. That was my son. I have been watching you. You are a great fighter. You're a great champion. But I saw that man when he was alive and at his best. And I really believe that if he were alive today and you and him were in the same arena, he would take you on his knee and he'd break you like a twig. He'd snap you in two. And the wrestler said, that man isn't even alive. You can't prove that. He said, I don't need to prove it. I just want you to know that I have seen that wrestler and he was better than you. The wrestler went home that night, couldn't sleep. Despite thousands of people who thought he was the best, all he could think about was one old man who thought he was second best. And in the middle of the night, he gets up, he goes to the statue, and he starts to have a monologue with the statue. I'd snap you like a twig. I'm the champion. I'm the best. No response, of course, from the statue. So finally, he takes hold of the ankles in the statue. He starts to shake it, and it falls on him and kills him. And the ancient storyteller asks, who killed that man? He was strong. He was the champion. Answer, pride killed that man. Could it be that we may be part of a generation that watches our beloved country as it tries to wrap its arms around the ankles of God, to prove to God that we can do it without Him. The awful pride of man. Let's get to the attribute. Let's talk about the attribute. That's the second theme in Nahum, the jealousy of God. It's in the very first chapter. Here it is. The Lord is jealous and an avenging God. The Lord takes vengeance and is filled with wrath. The Lord takes vengeance on his foes and vents his wrath against his enemies. The Lord's slow to anger, but great in power. The Lord will not leave the guilty unpunished. Who's going to protect little Israel, they said, from our armies? Nahum is saying, God is a God of vengeance and jealousy. He's going to destroy the city. You know, I sometimes people read these statements from God and they get offended. Does that offend you? That God is a jealous God, an avenging God, filled with wrath? A lot of people find that kind of talk about God offensive. Nahum is saying to Nineveh, you're thumbing your nose at God. And you're destroying nations and being brutal. And now you're threatening God's people. And people are actually starting to say, where's Israel's God? Does he have integrity? Nahum says it's time for God to deal with you, Nineveh, because he's a jealous God. He's jealous of his integrity, and he's protective of his people. I think as Nahum's preaching this, he has no idea how God is going to destroy this great and powerful city. But he knows what God is like. He knows what God is like. And he knows his God is a jealous God and an avenging God. I'm interested that if you read Nahum, there's so many references to nature in the verses. Look at this in chapter 1. His way is in the whirlwind and the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and dries it up. He makes all the rivers run dry. Bashan and Carmel wither, and the blossoms of Lebanon fade. The mountains quake before him, and the hills melt away. The earth trembles at his presence, the world and all who live in it. Who can withstand his indignation? Who can endure his fierce anger? His wrath is poured out like fire. The rocks are shattered before him. All these are manifestations of nature. God always has the last move. He always has the last move. And though Israel, and though Nineveh has 100-foot walls, 100-foot towers, a deep moat, God has his way in the whirlwind and the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. It's very interesting to me that still in our time, with all of our knowledge, with all we've learned about nature, about science, about medicine, with all that power we have and knowledge, God still has the last move. He's able to hit the pause button and bring the world to its knees in one virus. God often uses nature, and God keeps sending messages to us through that. And he's saying, I have the last move, and when I want to make that move, I can make it. I can make this world stop on a dime. You know how Nineveh was destroyed? By a great flood. Nineveh was situated where three rivers come together, kind of like Pittsburgh. And Nahum sees the day when this prideful, arrogant city will be destroyed by these three rivers. Here's the verse. The Lord is good, a refuge in times of trouble. He cares for those who trust in him. But with an overwhelming flood, he will make an end of Nineveh. I'm not sure if Nahum knew that it was actually going to be a flood, but that's what happened. Does God care about Nineveh? Of course he does. Of course he does. He sent them Jonah 100 years before Nahum. You remember that? He sends them Jonah, preaches to them to repent. He saves them from judgment. But a generation has gone by, and these people now are bent on destroying God's integrity and attacking God's people. And so Nahum says, God's not going to put up with it anymore. He's going to deal with this city, and he's going to preserve his people, Israel. Folks, I don't have to tell you, there's a lot going on in our world right now. And I think if you're an honest person, you're thinking and wondering, what's God doing here? I mean, what is he doing? What's he trying to communicate to all of us? And while I can't speak for God, I do know what God is like, that God is justice. He's jealous, and he's jealous to preserve his integrity, and he's jealous to protect his people. Just as he dealt with Nineveh in its arrogance and pride, he may be at work in our day dealing with not only the pride of nations, but maybe even our nation, and the pride of people, and yes, also maybe dealing with his church. You know, I'm telling you, the last 3 weeks, I've been amazed at how I'm watching Christians respond, and they're no different than the world's response. I'm telling you, no difference. They're claiming their rights. I'm not hearing much about submission, and they're claiming their rights. They're joining the political views, and they got strong opinions, and they're ready to attack. I'm going to talk about that in a couple of weeks, how Christians' response to all this stuff needs to be following the example of Christ. But there's no question God is forcing all of us to put all the distractions away and the things that would threaten our relationship with Him. God is jealous about that. God is glorified in the world, not by how many Christians there are, not how big our churches are, not how many votes we carry, not how much money we have. The glory of God in the world is displayed in the holiness and the integrity of His people. And God is jealous to keep that and protect that. And He will do whatever He needs to do to get us there. Let me pray with you. Bow your heads. Lord, thank You for the witness of Nahum. And we do live in a world right now that is confused. It's fearful. It doesn't know what the future may hold. And believers right now need to have their head in this book. We need to be filtering everything through who You are as God and what are Your ways. And I pray, God, for Your people here, You will keep transforming our minds and getting us there, getting us focused on that, so then we can interpret the events of our day and do it not only in a right way, but with a right attitude. I pray, God, that You'll do great and wonderful things in our congregation over these next couple of weeks as we address this from Your word. Thank You, God, for Your goodness to us. Thank You that You do protect Your church, and You're jealous to do that. In Jesus' name, amen.